Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. Thanks for joining me again this week. As always, appreciate all the reports and observations folks share in person and via email. If you've been seeing some stuff and you're curious about it or hearing things, if you can get a recording, feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. You can post your observations there and share those with others. This last couple of weeks, as we're here kind of the last part of July and really on the downslope of summer, lots of lush greenness out in the plant world. Still the late summer bloomers and the earlier bloomers are going to seed. Fireweed's definitely out, nice flowers, and the birds are out as a lot of juveniles are around. So not hearing as much singing recently, but a lot of activity, and sometimes that actually makes for better observations. Not the best time of year always for looking in your bird book and trying to identify things, because sometimes the young birds or the molting adults don't look quite like they might in the bird book, but still a nice time to just watch them and their behavior. The young birds are out and they're kind of oblivious and don't really pay too much attention to things, and so you can get good looks at those. And the parents are just so busy trying to keep the still begging juveniles fed that they are a little less wary than they might otherwise be as well. So if you're out there around, you might check out some of the, especially the elderberry bushes, if you can find them while the berries are still on and red. I noticed quite a few of them turning ripe, at least down at low elevations right now, and the thrushes especially just seem to love those berries, and they can strip a bush off pretty quickly once those turn ripe. I spent a little time this last week watching one of those, and watching Swainson's and hermit thrushes and berry thrushes and robins all just picking on those berries. If you were in Sitka this past week, maybe you had a chance on Tuesday. It was overcast. The forecast had been for sunny, and I was kind of a little disappointed that the sun didn't really come out. But then that evening, it was just one of the most brilliant sunsets that I've seen. The overcast still over town, but the sun dipped below and just illuminated those clouds with just brilliant pinks and kind of the purples in the shade, and it was just an amazing thing to watch. And then later that evening, it actually cleared up enough, and there were some noctilucent clouds. If you've not had a chance to see those before, if there's a clear evening, look kind of to the northwest after midnight. Between midnight and one is when I saw them, and they're these high kind of they're described as electric blue sort of wispy clouds up there, that they're super high elevation clouds, so they're still catching the sunlight even though it's well below the horizon locally. So that's something maybe to keep an eye out for. This last week was also the lowest tide of the year. Last Sunday was a -3, and during this low tide cycle, I was able to get down to the beach several times, and both John Brown's Beach and Sage Beach down at the near the Science Center there, and also at Magic Island at Halibut Point Rec. And it was fun to explore some of the intertidal stuff and see the creatures down there, investigate it a little bit more. The eelgrass surf quest question I've been holding for a while. I'm trying to learn to tell the difference between those things, and maybe a little esoteric for most folks, but yeah, it was something I enjoyed doing. And another thing that I enjoyed doing while down at the beach was visiting with my guests for this week's show. It's Matt Bracken and Cascade Sortie. They're in town. They're from University of California, Irvine is where they both teach now. They're in town as part of the Scientists in Residence Fellowship Program at the Sitka Sound Science Center, and I had a chance to visit with them in the studio this week. But before that, I had gone down to the beach and looked at some of what they were doing, and setting up some experiments and looking at what some of the effects might be of different changes that can occur as a result of climate change. In particular for them, they were looking at the changes in temperature and changes in acidity, and so they're actually doing some manipulations of the smaller tide pools there. So we'll join that conversation with Cascade, explaining a little bit the general context of climate change research and how their work fits in to that.
Most of the climate change work that has been done, mm-hmm. or the data that people use to infer that climate change is having an effect, has been looking at changes over time. Mm-hmm. But the problem with that is that so many things are changing over time that you can't really narrow it down to, is this a climate change effect? Is it an effect of, say, increased population, increased trampling by people? You know, there are so many things that are happening at the same time. And so if you use a manipulative experiment, then you can, you know, change different things at different tide pools. And if you see that the tide pools that you're warming are changing more than the ones that you're not warming, then, you know, you see that there's something happening that's really specifically caused by climate change, or in this case, our pretend climate
right.
change.
Right. So, in this case, the pretend climate change consists of warming up the water or was it, if I'm remembering correctly, bubbling in carbon dioxide?
Right, and that's what I spent most of today working on, is and last night, is putting together these, they're waterproof boxes.
Oh, yeah.
Otter boxes, like you'd use to put your camera in if you're going to go out in your kayak or something like that. And they have a airline tubing like you'd use in a fish tank that runs to an aerostone. But then I had to make them more field rugged. So if you were to go out there and look at John Brown's Beach, you see they look like kind of like Frankenstein boxes with strange tubing coming out of them and metal banding and things like that. And they're, you know, they're lashed down to the rock so that they don't wash away if the storm hits or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Well, I noticed it's pretty calm today, but that's no guarantee of the next. You're going to have these out there for a couple or 3 weeks. Is that the plan?
Yeah, so we've been watching the weather.
Yeah.
See what's coming.
Yeah.
So far, so good.
Sometimes it's pretty, I mean, most times it's fairly calm this time of year, but John Brown's is a little bit out there where it can get splashed. And so you go, so the CO2 coming in is to, if I understand how this works correctly, part of the whole climate change thing is driven by increase of CO2 in the atmosphere, but that CO2 in the atmosphere then actually permeates into the water, also dissolves into the water.
Right.
Exactly.
And then that actually increases the acidity of the water. And so we hear about ocean acidification, which is a problem for things that like to build shells, I guess, really.
Well, and not only those. So, you think about, so if you add carbon dioxide to water, it produces carbonic acid. That's why soda pop has pop, right? Why it's fizzy and it tastes good. And, you know, you can taste the difference between still water and sparkling water. And that difference, that fizzy difference that tastes good, is actually the acidity of it.
Oh, okay.
Because, you know, acidic things taste pretty good, right? You know, like eating an orange or something like that. And when you add carbon dioxide to water, it produces carbonic acid. And one of the issues that you just talked about, right, is that the hydrogen ions, which is what makes it acidic, the hydrogen ions in the water, they bind with carbonate in the water. And carbonate is what things that build shells use to build their shells. And so these are like mussels and clams. Fish build their otoliths out of it, things like that, right?
Yeah.
So that's problem number one, is that things that need to build shells can't build shells as well. Problem number two is simply the fact that when you change the acidity of any solution, it poses challenges to the organisms that live there, because so many biological processes are based on how acidic or how basic things are. Mm-hmm. And these range from, you know, in our own bodies, the delivery of oxygen to oxygen-starved cells is actually an acid-base regulated process.
Mm-hmm.
The way that fish smell. So salmon use maybe olfactory cues to come back to the streams that they need to come back to. There's a great case in the tropics where, you know, they use Nemo, the clownfish, right?
Right, right.
And they show that they can't actually make it back to the proper environment. So the larval fish that are trying to get back, if you increase the acidity, it messes with their olfactory function, with their noses, basically, how well they smell the water. And they can't get back to where they need to get back, to the proper habitat.
So it can be, I suppose it depends on the organism, but a fair amount of sensitivity. And I guess I don't know, I mean, when I was there the other day at the beach, you guys were actually measuring pH as it changed. And it was a sunny day, and we haven't had a lot of those since you've been here, but the sun was out that day. And the pH was raising, is that, if I remember right? Because like the algae were taking up the carbon as part of the respiration.
Right, it varies
water.
A lot. I mean, we've measured pH, or I've measured pH of about 7.5 to 8.5 out there, you know, easily.
Yeah.
And that's the changes that we're expecting with climate change over the next 100 years is about 0.2. So if you think about that, it varies, you know, one whole unit, but we're only expecting about a fifth of that change over the next 100 years. But what's interesting is, you know, you talked about how increasing the acidity of the ocean makes it harder for species to build their shells.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, it's taking away something they need. But at the same time, adding carbon dioxide to the water is helping things like the algae that take up carbon dioxide. And so that's why we think of there being winners and losers from climate change. So you're taking away a resource for some species. You're taking away their carbonate that they need to make shells. But you're adding CO2 that's a resource for other species. And so we're hoping that we'll see some dynamics out there where some of the species, if they're going to do better with more CO2, maybe we'll see them increase. And Maybe we'll see decreases of some of the species where we're taking away what they need.
I mean, that's one of the most amazing things to think about, right, is that plants are taking CO2 from the atmosphere. And if you walk through the woods around here and you see these massive trees, every bit of carbon in those trees came from the atmosphere, right, from drawing down CO2 and using it to build mass, to build biomass and structure. And the seaweeds and tide pools are no exception, so they're using that carbon dioxide that's ultimately coming from the atmosphere being dissolved in the seawater as a source of carbon to then grow, right? But these tide pools, when they're isolated at low tide, that carbon can get drawn down.
Yeah.
And so they can actually be carbon limited. And so by adding carbon dioxide into those pools, we've found, for example, in my work in New England, that some species, especially fast-growing seaweeds, really can capitalize on that resource and grow much more effectively when you add carbon dioxide.
So it's almost like you're fertilizing the system,
okay.
Right? Yeah. And the ones that are doing really well are the really weedy ones, just like when you fertilize a field, sometimes it's the weeds that capitalize on that if they're there.
I mean, they don't really have roots, so are they just, they're absorbing everything they need out of the water, basically, the seaweeds?
Right. Seaweeds don't have differentiated tissues. That's one of the things that sort of defines seaweeds as opposed to terrestrial plants. And what that means is that every part of the seaweed can pretty much do everything it needs to do. So they can take up nutrients, they can take up carbon dioxide, all of those different functions. Some parts do better than others, but you're right. The part of a seaweed that kind of looks like roots, if you think about these kelp that are growing out there, if you've seen a chunk of kelp that's washed up on the beach and it's still attached to the rock it was growing on, those root-like structures, that's called a holdfast. That's really just to keep it anchored to the bottom. It doesn't actually provide a function in terms of acquiring nutrients or water like the roots of a tree do.
And so your background, if you've studied seaweeds, is kind of your what you've spent a lot of time on?
I spent a lot of time studying seaweeds. I mean, at the core of what I do is really community ecology.
Oh, okay.
So I try to understand the interactions between all of the different organisms that live in a particular location. But I think seaweeds are amazing.
Yeah.
The different ways that they deal with their environments. I actually got into seaweeds. It's kind of funny. I had a pretty good handle on marine invertebrates. I'd studied them for a while. I grew up poking around in tide pools, just like the kids here in Sitka do.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up in Petersburg, and turning over rocks and trying to figure out what was there. And I said, all right, I kind of understand the invertebrates, but I really want to understand the seaweed. And so as a graduate student, I went up to Friday Harbor Labs in Washington State. It's the marine lab of the University of Washington.
Is that on San Juan Island?
Yeah, exactly, on San Juan Island.
Yeah.
And in the summer, they have these fantastic courses that are about 5-week, really intense courses. And I took a course in marine botany. And that was my first real introduction other than just kind of like, oh, the slippery stuff on the rocks to seaweeds.
Yeah.
And I was absolutely hooked because they're so amazing because of the strategies that they use to cope with this really variable environment because of their colors and variety and shapes, and their life cycles are absolutely amazing. They have all these neat strategies from that perspective, and their evolutionary origins are also amazing in terms of, you know, you have the seaweeds that are growing out there are actually, you know, if you think about higher taxonomy, they're from multiple kingdoms. So you have the brown algae that are from a completely different kingdom than the green and red algae, which are plantae and more related to the terrestrial plants. So it's they're really, really neat. And just kind of thinking about how they do what they do, I find
So the
really
browns are like the kelps and our popweed.
Yep, rockweed and kelps are brown algae.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just kind of starting to learn my seaweeds. There's a nice book for Seaweeds of Alaska, which has most of the common ones that we would see around here. And but it's kind of, you know, you go down to the beach and there's just a lot of stuff there. You know, it's all very rich. And then there's, I mean, more so, I mean, obviously there are seasonal components to what you see on land, but it seems like it's even stronger. Like there are pretty narrow windows that some of these things show up. And I just was at Magic Island yesterday and noticed there. I think in the Seaweeds of Alaska book, they call them like rubber thread seaweed or something like it. Now, I can't remember the scientific name, but they're basically red algae that's just, it looks like little rubber worms or something that's just hanging there. And I hadn't noticed those before, but it says in there they're a summer seaweed, but then there's other ones that are spring seaweeds. And I know there's a little green one that shows up. It starts showing up really, I start seeing it green up the high intertidal in like sometimes late December, but certainly January and February, but it's, you don't even see it at all now. And so it's kind of intimidating, I should say, and also fascinating that there's, I mean, there's these very specific periods, and I have no idea what's driving that. I mean, I don't know if you have any idea part of how they're doing. I mean, where do they go when they're not there? Are they just there in little microscopic little dots, or
when I was talking about seaweed life histories, right? A lot of them have what's called alternation of generations, which is a fancy way of saying that they have multiple life history stages and they can alternate between them. And so you'll have, in some of these species, you'll have an upright form that is what we're used to seeing. It looks kind of like a plant. But then the other phase that it alternates between would maybe be a crustose form. This just looks like sort of a crust or a slimy, slippery stuff on the rocks. And it turns out that in some cases they alternate between those seasonally.
Yeah.
And so the same species might have its upright form in the wintertime when herbivores aren't as active, but nutrient levels are really, really high. They tend to be higher in the winter because, you know, phytoplankton productivity out in the open ocean is taking up a lot of the nutrients as the summer progresses, and that's what sort of fuels the system. But in the winter, there's a lot of nutrients available, and these seaweeds capitalize on those resources, and they really crank when there aren't herbivores out there. And a lot of them can get by on fairly low light levels. But then in the summer, maybe when the herbivores are active or the nutrients aren't as plentiful, they'll alternate into this more crustose form. And those also tend to be more resistant to heat and desiccation, which aren't necessarily a huge problem here in Sitka. But, you know, the tide goes out. These are marine organisms, and they have to cope with the conditions on the rocks.
And so I guess that kind of brings me back to you guys. You're based out of California now. And have you been there for very long yet?
We got there January 1st, so about 6 months.
Not too long. But you did some research, Cascade, in California, intertidal, or actually you spoke about that the other morning.
We were in California before we were out in Massachusetts, we were in California from 2004 to, I guess I was doing research there until about 2012-ish, really.
Yeah.
By the time I finished my PhD and all our projects there. And then we were in Massachusetts kind of overlapping with that.
Oh, okay.
So we know Northern California better. Southern California has been really interesting, though, because there are a lot of differences once you get south of Point Conception. And Matt's been talking about that a lot, just how the diversity changes.
Yeah.
Because in some ways, the diversity, especially in the algae, that you see here in Alaska is more similar to Northern California than between Northern and Southern California.
So there's kind of if I'm remembering the currents right, there's kind of one that goes, it runs south along the west coast for quite a ways, and actually an offshore flow. Sometimes it results in a cold water upwelling, and maybe that's, you know, it's kind of this southeast Alaska, sort of the northern end, and I guess Northern California must be the southern end of this kind of ecosystem.
The current, well, you know, you see the coastline going less north to south and more east to west once you get south of Point Conception over by the Channel Islands. But yeah, you have this southern flowing California current, and then sometimes a counter current, the Davidson current, that flows from south to north. And so for the most part, the current is going along the shore when it's north to south.
Yeah.
And still kind of learning about this. Because we're really interested, a lot of the work that I do is on marine invertebrates, and so I'm interested in, you know, where do they go when they're dispersing in the currents. And so trying to figure out how much do they go from south to north against these currents, and how much from north to south, and trying to figure that out in the context of climate change, just because we want to know, can some of the individuals from southern populations that might be more used to the warmer temperatures get to the northern populations, and so...
So I suppose, I mean, no matter how you slice it, the intertidal stuff in and of itself is kind of, it's rough country. I mean, you're subject to exposure and inundation. And I had a guy in that really likes in intertidal invertebrates. And one of the things he was talking about is you have this kind of, especially the upper intertidal, this mixing zone of terrestrial things that are sort of getting a little bit aquatic, like your leather limpets and some of the isopods. And then you have some marine things that are sort of getting... you know, on the edge of terrestrial, and it's kind of like, and it's amazing that they're there. I mean, like saltwater, freshwater, you know, if it's a super high tide pool, sometimes it might not get there the saltwater might not get there every high tide. And here it's so rainy, and so it would actually tend to make it much more freshwater. I suppose in California, where it's not as rainy, but you get evaporation. salinity might increase pretty dramatically, right, and temperature. And
you see
these
funny
things,
kind of like a little bathtub ring around, mm-hmm, tide pools. I don't know if you've seen that when you've been poking around, mm-hmm, on the beach. You see it here, and you see a similar sort of thing in California. But I think, like you say, they're driven by really different things. So I think in where it gets much warmer, you have evaporation, and that stresses out the organisms that live right at the lip of these tide pools. Because, like you said, some of these pools are not only isolated for, say, 24 hours because they're only hit by the highest of the two tides of the day. But, you know, if you think about the way the tidal cycle works during the month, you'll have a period of really big tides and then, yeah, a period of really small tides. So you have these spring tides, which are the really big ones, and you have neap tides, which are sort of during the quarter moon that are right in the, mm-hmm, in the middle, right, and the tides aren't as high. During those neap tide series is when these really high tide pools, they may not see the tide for, say, 4 or 5 days at a time.
Yeah.
And that can be a real problem, right? And how do these organisms cope with that? And so here, what we see is you see this bathtub ring of sort of, and I think it's because of fresh water accumulates at the top. But, yeah, down in California and Oregon, you see this sort of zone around the lip of the pool because of evaporation.
Evaporation.
One of the things I was interested in for my PhD work is you have these seaweeds that you know, they're living in these high pools, and how do they do it?
Yeah.
And it turns out, and it's the same species you have here, this really neat red alga. It turns out that it provides a really good spot for baby mussels to recruit, mm-hmm, to. So the little larval mussels, they come out of the water column, they're in the plankton, and then they need a good place to land. And it turns out that this seaweed provides the perfect place for them to land, right? So the little mussels come into the seaweed, and then they settle down into the tide pools. And what ultimately happens is you end up with the mussels growing down on the bottom of the tide pools, and then the seaweed sort of growing on top of them. And what I found is that all of the nutrients that the seaweeds in these tide pool needs can be produced locally by the mussels that are living, or the invertebrates that are living in these tide pools.
Yeah.
So you actually have tide pools become their own separate ecosystems because of this separation from the ocean. And that's a really, really neat system.
So in those cases, I mean, basically you have the invertebrates that essentially the waste of one group is the food of the other group.
Exactly.
And this kind of cycle.
And vice versa,
yeah,
right? Because, yeah, the invertebrates are producing carbon dioxide in the tide pools, mm-hmm, via respiration. And the seaweeds in the tide pools are then taking up via photosynthesis that carbon, but they're producing oxygen, which the,
yeah,
invertebrates in the pools need. And so even though they're isolated, you can have these really neat little self-functioning systems.
Yeah. Well, that sounds good. I never hadn't really thought about that, but it seems. And then, you know, periodically you get this influx of new material essentially,
right,
when the tide comes up. But otherwise, they can kind of go along there, helping each other out. Which is, I hadn't really thought about that. So it's kind of interesting to think about those. I guess that would make nice sort of labs, or I mean, maybe that's why you've chosen to do what you're doing. Essentially, they make these nice little microcosms of kind of bigger processes that we hope to understand in like the big scale, where there's a lot of stuff going on, but it's not very cheap to run experiments on ecosystem-wide scales. So,
well, and you run into things like ethical concerns,
right,
with manipulating,
yeah,
larger organisms and fish and those types of things at the big scale. And so by looking at stuff in these tide pools, they can act like a microcosm of the larger marine system, and we hope to get a handle on the processes that are operating there and how these systems respond to things like warming and CO2 additions.
So in terms of habitats that are most likely to be resistant to climate change, probably intertidal stuff it's got to be pretty high up there, I would imagine.
Well, yeah, I was going to come back to that, because you were talking about how the species out there are used to seeing really large ranges,
yeah,
in what we already said, in pH and temperature on a day-to-day basis, in salinity. So, you know, some people have said that these are systems where you kind of have these jack of all trades, you know, they can,
mm-hmm,
they can handle a really broad range. And that's why some people have suggested too that the species that might be the most in trouble would be the species that are living, say, in the tropics, where they don't see as much variation. But yeah, I think some people think that intertidal systems will have a leg up because they have some ways of coping, you know, but all of these species have their limits.
Right.
And so we're just trying to figure out what are those limits, and how much can we push them beyond their limits, and how far can they acclimate, you know, because you would probably guess that those that are living, say, down in Southern California, where they see more heat waves and, mm-hmm. and more higher temperatures would maybe be able to do better, at least initially, than the species up here, where it is a little bit more temperate.
Yeah.
And since we're expecting that the temperature should rise more at higher latitudes, like up here in Alaska, then, you know, within that community across space, Alaska might be a place where you'd be likely to see more changes than other places.
If you joined us late, welcome. This is Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, and a conversation I recorded just a few days ago with Cascade Sortie and Matt Bracken, the scientists and residency fellows at the Sitka Sound Science Center. They're doing some work on possible effects of climate change and intertidal ecology. And this next section here, we talk a little bit more about some of the possible effects or ways that climate change could affect some of these creatures. Yeah, one of the things that's sort of interesting me to think about, a species that's terrestrial species, a yellow cedar, is one that's seen a lot of research over the years because of what they call yellow cedar decline. And I guess, as I understand it, I don't know that it's proven per se, but the best hypothesis and what they think is happening is that with the warming of winters in particular, there's less snow cover, but we still get these Arctic outflow events. So we still are subject periodically to these cold blasts in the wintertime. And that's actually what the cedars are sensitive to. The ends of their roots are sensitive to that and freeze, and then that weakens the tree, and ultimately the tree dies. And so in this case, it's a warming creating less snow, but it's still the cold that's killing them. And so I wonder, like in the case of intertidal things, like it's warmer and they do better in the summer, but then we still have these cold events in the winter, and that, like, maybe that's going to be harder for them to deal with the kind of
right.
the range of
so
extremes.
So they are still going to have to be able to cope with those cold temperatures. So they're going to need to broaden their mm-hmm. temperature range. And then just beyond that, there are so many different environmental factors that they're having to deal with. One thing that I've been really interested in is trying to figure out which of these is going to be, like, is it the straw that broke the camel's back? You
right.
know, I mean, is it going to be temperature? Is it going to be pH? Is it going to be one that we haven't studied yet, like salinity? Something about food availability, because we know food availability is linked to these really large oceanic processes, and if those change, then, you know, how will changes in food availability affect their ability to deal with all these other things? So, you know, there's just all these different factors that are feeding into their success or their current success.
And on top of that, there's not only are, say, temperatures predicted to rise, but it's also the variability in those temperatures mm-hmm. predicted to increase as well. And I know, you know, Cascade, you've done some work to tease out that difference between just the increase in temperatures, but also these changes in variability, temperature variability. So that's another really important aspect. And again, what you're getting at with this, you know, you lose your insulating layer of snow, but you still have these Arctic blasts that are coming through.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you've seen us out in the field and kind of seen what we're setting up out there. And in this case, we're just trying to study changes in mm-hmm. temperature and changes in pH, and you know, we're not doing anything per se with variability in those factors. We're doing it in one season, we're doing it with one community at one tide height.
Yeah,
you know, it shows you what a big problem it is to solve, you know.
And so I guess
mystery.
To that end, I'm curious if you sort of go in and do you sort of I suppose on the side think, I think these guys will be the winners and these guys will be the losers in this tide pool with this manipulation? Or do you just kind of have really no idea what's going to happen after a month?
You know, that's interesting. We haven't talked about this. We've been going so hard trying to get this experiment set up that we haven't actually sat down and started to make some prediction about it. A couple of things that we have said, though. One thing is that we don't know how well we'll be able to track the mobiles, because we call them mobiles.
Right.
By that we mean anything that moves,
right.
which is really sort of the small things out there, because the algae and the seaweeds are so dominant. But, you know, will we be able to track changes in snails or anything that moves? Because that's where you might be able to see some change. Like maybe the snails will flee the tide pool, or mm-hmm. Especially we're kind of interested to see if the sea stars will flee the tide pools, because we're not used to seeing so many sea stars up high in the intertidal like we do here in Sitka. And I have to imagine that that's because of the lower temperatures here than other places that we've worked, although, you know, public visitation is probably also affecting that. But it would be really interesting if we saw that in the heated pools, the sea stars just, left immediately. So
yeah.
I put the warmers in today, right next to some sea stars. So I'm really curious to see if I'll see changes there. What are you expecting as far as the algae, Matt? Because you would have more predictions about that.
It's interesting to look at the algal community here and think about what might happen. The one big winner that we've seen in some places are what you'd call sea lettuce, these green algae. We don't see them in very many of the tide pools up high where we're working. And that may be a seasonal thing. They may have already sort of started dying back for the season. I don't know. That would have been one of my predicted winners as you add carbon dioxide to these pools. In terms of losers among the algae, it's hard to tell. Most of these species are the same species that I recognize from Oregon and Northern California. And so from that perspective, unless they're really locally adapted, they should be able to exist over a much broader range of temperatures. So we don't, it's hard to tell.
We also just, since this is our first time doing an experiment like this in Sitka, we're not really sure how fast these species are going to grow. And actually, Matt was telling me a story back from his thesis work and saying that it took him a little while to figure out with the species that he was using, which was Odonthalia, at what season it was growing maximally. Because, ideally you would go out there and do your experiment where they are growing so that if there's a difference, you can see it.
Right.
If they're just going to sit there and not do very much, then it's really hard to see very small, minor changes. So we're not really sure how fast things are going to grow. There are so many other unknowns here. And so...
That particular,
this is going to be interesting to see what happens.
That particular seaweed, which is the one I was talking about, that facilitates the mussels that come in and then provide nutrients to it. It turns out that's one of those species that grows from about January to June and then starts dying off.
Yeah.
Right? And that's actually about the dominant algal species we see in the tide pools here. So it could be that it's sort of, maybe that one is on the wane in terms of its seasonal pattern. And, did we miss the window? I don't know.
Yeah,
we'll find out.
One thing I do think, if I had a guess of where we'll see the biggest difference, will be in the tissue measurements. So we collected some algal tissues today, and we'll look at how much carbon is inside the little collections of algae that we took, and how much nitrogen is there. And since we're adding carbon dioxide to some of the pools, we would expect that the amount of carbon dioxide or amount of carbon in those samples would go up. And so I'm thinking we might see something actually just within the individual, even though you wouldn't be able to see it with the naked eye.
Yeah.
It's almost like it changes how nutritious the algae is for things that are eating it.
The other possibility is we're doing these measurements of system-level productivity. And by that you think of productivity as the rate at which stuff accumulates. But you can use as a surrogate for that, you can look at the rate of oxygen production, because primary producers, in this case the seaweeds, are producing oxygen, right? And invertebrates in these tide pools are taking that oxygen up. And so we can get a handle on that process. So that's sort of a short-term surrogate for a longer-term index of how productive the system is. And so a few days ago, when you were out there watching us on the rocks, we were doing measurements of oxygen in these pools. And we started off early in the day by taking an initial measurement of oxygen. And then we covered up the tide pools, all of those tide pools, for a half hour. And if you think about it, what that does is, it by blocking light, by covering these tide pools, and we just did it with black plastic, with visqueen, covered up the tide pools, blocked the light, and then that shuts down photosynthesis. So oxygen is no longer being produced, and the seaweeds and the invertebrates living in those tide pools are then going to consume oxygen via respiration. And so you can get a handle on what's going on in terms of respiration in each of those tide pools. And then we took the plastic away. We took another measurement, then we took the plastic away, and then we let them sit for another half hour or 45 minutes, and then took a third measurement. And that third measurement, that difference there will give you a handle on, over that exact period of time, how much oxygen the seaweeds are producing. And by subtracting it, you can get a handle on how much production there is, how much respiration there is. And we did that initially, so before we set the experiment up, before all of the treatments were put in place, and then we'll do it again before we leave. And that's another one. It could be that maybe the composition of the community doesn't change very much. Maybe a few species leave or something like that. But what may happen is you have physiological changes in the individuals that are there mm-hmm. that result in changes in primary productivity.
And so you're hoping then for another sunny day towards the end, because I imagine that makes a big difference, like the intensity of sunlight probably.
It does, but it's really interesting. So when I was out there today, it was a mm-hmm. pretty bright day.
Yeah.
It's overcast, but it was sort of light overcast. It was the first day we were out there that you could look all the way across to Kruzhof and see entire outline of Mount Edgecumbe, right? Which is, and so when you have these really bright, high overcast days, actually, I should have brought a light meter with me. I didn't have time to take those measurements, but a lot of these pools that on a really, really sunny day might be shadowed because of where they're sitting with relation to the trees or the rocks. Mm-hmm. On a day like today, they're probably getting a lot more light.
Interesting.
And so there might be some differences like that that we could capitalize on too.
Huh. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that. But yeah, it makes sense. I mean, it's more diffuse light, obviously.
Right.
But the direct light, you get the shade. And
It's the same thing when you were talking about how difficult it is sometimes to take pictures, right on a really sunny day versus a cloudy day.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's kind of interesting thing. I mean, the day that we were there was the one larger tide pool that had a bunch of dead, I think they were all sandlands, and you said you'd seen them schooling the day before mm-hmm. in that tide pool, and then I remember you went over and checked the oxygen level and it was like super saturated. And it was sunny, and I actually looked in there and there's little bubbles forming on the green plants and things, which I guess as you were telling me was actually the oxygen coming out, and it's not dissolving into the water because it's already saturated. But you know, maybe they underdid their oxygen at night when there was, I mean, if they used it all up because there were so many of them. So that time of day thing and how much the oxygen in an isolated pool, I mean, I don't know how fast the oxygen can rise and fall. Do you guys have a sense of like?
So when I covered those tide pools mm-hmm. for about a half hour, and we haven't really analyzed the data, but I looked at them in terms of sort of, well, did we see a change?
Yeah.
And oxygen concentrations dropped by about half.
Oh, wow.
So
in just a half hour.
In about a half hour. So if you had an oxygen level of, say, 10 milligrams per liter or something like that, cover the pool, about a half hour later, it would be on the order of about 5.
Wow.
And so things do consume oxygen very, very quickly when it's dark, which at least around here, it's not dark for very long at night.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But lucky for those animals that there are algae in there, you know, replenishing the oxygen.
Right. Well, and so that big tide pool, I mean, the little sculpins were still swimming around fine. But, you know, when I think about just pulling them out and looking at them, they don't seem, I mean, I'm sure it's not there's not a happy time for them, but they seem like they do all right out of water for a little bit of time. And other fish, just like they're gasping and they don't last very long. So I wonder, I mean, living in a tide pool, it would make sense that if I'm remembering correctly, actually, when the temperature warms, it can hold less oxygen in the water. And so they're probably subject to these kind of low oxygen environments in the intertidal range and maybe are more capable of handling that than these other fish that were in there. And maybe that was kind of like, maybe that was a problem. There was hundreds of them in there, I think, bunches. And so if they used it all up, then...
But yeah, a little science on the side.
Yeah.
That was kind of great. That was, you know, your son that discovered that and found these dead fish in there. And that led to us doing a little, you know, investigation with everything that we could think of. We measured temperature, pH, oxygen, you know, anything that we could think of that would tell us why those fish had died. But we still couldn't get to the bottom of it, so.
Yeah, it was, I mean, they were all very much dead. And they hadn't been eaten yet. I'm sure that were going to make good meals for all the little
hermit
crabs
and stuff.
They
were still out there when I looked today, so that's been 2 days they've been sitting out there. I saw some stars going over there, so I was wondering if the sea stars would chomp up a dead fish.
Do they, I mean, I don't have any idea. Do the sea stars, do they, like, can they smell food in the water, essentially? Is that how they find stuff? Or
I don't really know. I know that they can sense light,
but
I don't know whether they smell things. Do you know the answer to that?
I don't know. I would guess that they probably can because they have to make a living somehow.
Although, I do have to say that there was one, well, actually there were about 5 that were trying to eat, or, you know, this was my impression, they were trying to eat one of the bolts that I'd put out that I really wanted to attach a cable tie to, and I had to, you know, question why they were focused on that bolt when it was not a living thing. You know, it made me wonder if...
Maybe they're iron deficient.
If they were able to sense things quite that well. And I had one eat an eye button one time, too.
Actually, oh, really? Actually, like, took it in?
Consume it. Well, that's my guess, because when I pulled the sea star off of it, it left a little empty spot with the eye button.
A little temperature logger.
So I didn't dissect the sea star. I didn't sacrifice it for the sake of answering that question. But I don't know. One thing we need to find out
is
how sea stars smell their prey.
How sea stars get around. Yeah, I mean, I don't, it's, in, I mean, the story that I've heard many times is about the solasters that eat the pycnopodias, and the pycnopodias are like death on everything in the type. So if you put a sol, but I guess what I was told is you have to put them, like, they have to be, as soon as they touch, then the pisaster, like, bolts and moves quickly, but in, they, it doesn't until they touch.
So in that
but
case, it's something actually about touch.
The touch, yeah. Huh.
But there, are, but most organisms, most invertebrates living in tide pools, or in general, if you just put a starfish in some water, and then take the starfish out, and you put snails or whatever in there, they'll actually buck and rear and try to get out of there as quickly as they possibly can.
As
they can sense the sea stars for sure.
Yeah, and I've heard that about the anemones, you know. I mean, not the anemones, the abalones. You just think that they're kind of mellow things, but they actually raise up and do this kind of wild gallop almost. Yep. You can imagine an abalone galloping. That's kind of what they do. And literally out of the tide pools. They'll go out of the touch tanks, I mean, like when they have them at the Science Center. This was back when SJ was there, and the professor that kind of started up a lot of the aquarium there, and she was talking about some of these just ecological relationships, predator prey things, and that they're like, it's time to get out of here. And so that seems like it's definitely a chemical presence in the water. But
how fast is this galloping? Is this galloping from a pretty nerd's perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it was just the motion. It's like it like the shell comes up off the, you're used to them being really affixed to the to the rock, and you got to pry them up. But it, they lifted up, kind of like he was describing with the snails. It lifted up and moved, and just started moving, and come right out, and come right out of the touch tank, and go. I never saw it myself. It was just the description that I heard. So I couldn't say.
Those things are definitely vicious. The
starfish,
sea stars out there,
The gulls get them sometimes. I don't know if the gulls eat them down there.
I haven't seen gulls down there, and it's amazing to me that those stars can just, you know, hang out in the kind of shell hash and between the cobbles and.
Well, here the wintertime is usually when you see gulls eating sea stars. I saw actually at Magic Island this, I guess it was probably March. It was kind of fascinating to me because I think it was a young bird. I think it was it had been at least a year that this gull had been out, because it was, or close to a year. And there was an adult bird, and this young gull was actually acting like it was begging, but there was a small pisaster there. And it was plucking the arms off of it and eating the arms one at a time. And
it's pretty comical when you see a gull try to eat a pisaster whole. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen that, when you've got part of it sticking out this way and two arms might be sticking out.
I always wonder what happens. I misspoke. It was a pycnopodia that that it was eating on, picking up the arms. But the pisasters, that's where you see the arm or two. And I'm like, maybe they can digest part of it, and I don't know. It doesn't make a lot, or if they just die, I'm like, do they starve because it gets stuck, or can they eventually get it down? I don't know. It seemed kind of strange. I did find once somebody in Washington. It may have been just like an undergraduate project, but they looked at they were trying to decide if there was a selective pressure on the color of the pisasters based on whether gulls were eating them or not when they were small. Because when they're small, they're a little easier to eat. And it seemed like I think if I'm remembering right, they found that the gulls did tend to get, I think part of what they did is they put out fake ones and they looked to see if the gulls went and looked at them, and that there was an advantage to being dark and not orange, at least in that area. And I suppose it would depend a lot on, you know, what kind of gull traffic you get. But it seems kind of, they're, you know, deep purple or bright orange, these pisasters are, and I guess they can be kind of brownish too. But
yeah, it seems like there's got to be some advantage to being bright too.
Yeah,
you know, like maybe the gulls learn that if they eat the big ones, then they can't swallow them.
Yeah,
so maybe they stop eating them.
Yeah,
you know, kind of like that.
It does seem to usually be young birds that are trying to choke down these starfish. But I don't know. Maybe it's good eating. I couldn't say, but I was also curious. You grew up in Petersburg, and you mentioned that you used to poke around in the tide pools and stuff. So were you interested in marine ecology from kind of a young age, or is that something you kind of discovered later and was like, oh, I remember doing that when I was a kid? But
I come by my interest in marine biology, honestly. My dad was a fisheries research and management biologist for Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of my interest in marine systems came from not only him being an excellent naturalist based on his biological training and taking me around as a kid and showing me stuff, a lot like you do with your kids, yeah. right? But also just coming back from field trips and whatever and dinner table conversations about biology and stuff like that. So I was definitely interested. I didn't know which way I was going to go in terms of that interest. You know, so I went to my undergraduate work at University of Puget Sound and got a biology degree. Always with an interest in marine stuff, but it wasn't until I got to college and I said, "Oh, wait a minute, I could actually just be a scientist. I could become a professor and do this for a job."
Yeah.
That possibility kind of presented itself, and I decided to run with it.
Yeah. Well, did you have sea weeks and stuff like?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, so sea week is great.
Yeah.
No, I think I've talked to you about sea week before.
Oh yeah, I know about sea week.
Did you have?
You don't have to be in Alaska to know about sea.
Did you have? I assume you didn't have them in Corvallis.
No.
Be like the logistics of getting to the coast for. But I remember. I mean, we went actually when I was a kid. We took the bus across the airport. Run. I don't think they let you do this anymore. I'm sure they don't let you do it. As a matter of fact, but and we went to the Causeway, which is just out from John Brown's Beach there. We went there a couple of times, but definitely to the park or out to Halibut Point Rec. I don't remember ever going to John Brown's Beach, but it was like a whole week or maybe even 2 weeks around a low tide series in usually April, May.
In April, yeah. May. And I remember some of them. One year they loaded us all in skiffs and took us across Rango Narrows to the other side to go nice. Over to this island. And I think that was, you know, each year there was a different theme, and I think that was the year we studied shorebirds. And
oh, so wow, yeah.
There was a spot you could go and look at shorebirds over there that was really neat.
How fun.
So, and it seemed like every, you know, like I said, every year had a slightly different theme to it, and we went to different places around the area, and it was really cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, growing up in Corvallis, you, of course, didn't have access to Sea Week in school, but somehow you managed to become a marine ecologist as well.
Yeah, I mean, we weren't too far from the ocean there. And I don't really know how I started wanting to be a marine biologist, but I definitely identified that as my goal when I was in the fourth grade.
Yeah.
Although it started a little bit before then. But I had this really influential fourth grade teacher who did a lot of things. She had a lot of animals in the classroom. She just did a lot that was beyond her normal job and I just felt so lucky to have had her as a teacher. And one of the things she did was organize a career day where everybody just, you know, identified some career that they'd like to have in the future. And then she helped make it possible for us to go shadow someone in that career. And so when I said I wanted to be a marine biologist, I was able to go to the Hatfield Marine Science Center, which is the Oregon State University Marine Science Center field station, and shadow some of the marine biologists there. And so, I mean, that was kind of the turning point for me.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was curious because Corvallis is where the main campus of Oregon State is, Oregon State University. And do they have a marine science program there then? I mean, it sounds like they have a field station at least.
Yeah, they have a couple of different programs. I mean, you know, Matt did his PhD there and that's where we met. So I went back and worked there after college. They have a zoology program or it was a zoology program. What is it now?
Integrated biology, I think.
That includes marine biology, so you could work there. But they also have a good oceanography program. They have a master's program in marine management. And then they have these field stations. So it's a land-grant college. And,
and a sea-grant college.
Land-grant, sea-grant. And so they have a station at the Hatfield Marine Science Center in Newport. And then they have some other branches of those field stations that also do marine work. There's one up in Astoria, Oregon that I actually worked at for 2 summers that does a lot with seafood technology, and so I worked there studying seafood technology for a couple of years. So,
which is a way of saying, you know, how many ways can you stretch surimi, right?
Yep. I was working with surimi or fake crab meat and crab with a K and helping make...
Is that made out of pollock?
Pollock generally? Or Pacific whiting.
Okay. You know?
Hake. Yeah. Hake.
Huh. So I was able to get a lot of experiences with my Oregon State connection, actually, that fed into my being ready to go on and get a degree in biology and get jobs in marine biology.
So what I think of Oregon, I think of, like, Oregon coast, giant sandy beaches. I've been to Cannon Beach, and there's the Haystack Rock there, and on the west coast of Washington, kind of the same, although there were some rocky places also, which is, let's just say, a little different than most of our beaches here in Sitka. Not so different than Yakutat. There's a lot of sand up there, but is it, so do you, I don't know, ideas of beaches in California also, but I don't really know what the coast is like there. But is the rocky kind of beach more interesting in many ways than the sandy beach, or is there a lot of interest on the sandy beaches too?
Well, it is to us.
Yeah.
We pretty much, you know, look at Google Earth and look for rocky places because we know that's where we'll see more permanent communities,
yeah.
you know, communities that have been developing for longer, because the sandy beach, I haven't studied the sandy beach too much, but it's just more of an ephemeral environment. You know, it's constantly changing. The sand goes in, the sand comes out, especially seasonally. But I have done some studies on sandy beach species. In fact, my first study that I ever did when I was in college that I did my senior thesis on was on the sand crab.
Oh, yeah.
And on larval dispersal of sand crabs. But, you know, those species that live on sandy beaches have to have pretty amazing adaptations to be able to persist in that environment, too, you know, because it is changing so much. You look like you're going to
say something. There's an interesting East Coast versus West Coast split among marine ecologists in terms of sandy versus rocky shores. I mean, what you can do rocky shore work on the East Coast as long as you're north of, I mean, the southernmost extent of rocky shore on the East Coast, on the entire East Coast, unless it's built as a jetty or coastal armoring or something like that, is Long Island.
Oh, wow.
That's the terminal moraine from the Ice Age, right? So the terminal moraines are Cape Cod and Long Island, right? And below that, it's all sand, clear all the way down to the tip of Florida. So there's a lot more work on sandy, soft sediment habitats on the East Coast. Here, like Cascade said, we focus on rocks, not only because, you know, it's a fun environment to work in, and it's easy to see the species, and it's easy to count stuff. I mean, people who do work in sandy environments, you have to take cores and bring them back and sort species, and there have been some really cool experiments done in those systems, but we find it a lot easier to experimentally approach rocky shore systems because you can actually attach stuff to the rocks, like we've done out here at John Brown's Beach, to manipulate the system in a way that is much more difficult to do in soft sediment habitats.
And so you guys' work is really driven by kind of this experimental idea. It's not just observational stuff and finding sort of natural experiments, so to speak, but actual manipulation type of experiments.
Although we've really done a little bit of all of those too. I mean, I use a space for time approach where, you know, I want to see how things will change as the climate changes. And so I can sort of get a sense on that by going from a cold place to a warm place and seeing how things change. And so in that case, I'm using that change in space as kind of a proxy for change in time. And then we've also both looked at historical comparisons. And so I think we try to put them all together.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
As being the best way to get a handle on this.
I mean, you think about the scientific method, right? The first step is observation,
right?
And then you form a hypothesis, and then you come up with an experiment to test that hypothesis.
Yeah.
I mean, the other way that you can think about it is an inductive method. So that would be a deductive method. There's also an inductive method where you could make a whole bunch of observations from a whole bunch of different places and say, all right, together those suggest that this is what's going on. They're just different approaches to understanding how a system works.
Yeah, and I guess it kind of depends on the scale. Like, there's only so big of a scale you can actually run an experiment at. So, I mean, you even selected, they weren't very big tide pools. I mean, as you were saying.
Between about 5 liters and 20 liters, I think.
Warming that much water, even
really
that
difficult.
Much water is not trivial.
Right.
I mean, in that environment. So, Oh, I had one other question that I wanted to ask, too, that you mentioned the larvae thing. And I was thinking, so that how do they even get back to where they are? Like, I mean, because if the currents are all moving one direction, pretty much, somewhere they have to loop back, because there's not a never-ending flow of northward organisms to keep feeding. Like, at some point, that they run out, right?
So that's right. It's putting together the behavior of the larvae, because a lot of these larvae are not completely passive, so they are behaving in different ways. And even by behaving as much as moving up and down in the water, they can kind of ride the tidal currents back, or they can get caught in the eddies that will keep them kind of locally entrained. So it's a mixture of that, and then the fact that there are water movements that replace the water that's moving away. So if there's water moving south, then some water has to fill in that water to the north. And some of it's coming from the north, but some of it's also coming from deep places. And the oceanography is really complex. So as I'm learning, a lot of the larvae do get moved away. A lot of them, though, also do come back to where they came from. And, you know, I think that's a process of many, many years of adaptation that have allowed these larvae to come up with strategies to.
So, I mean, you think about the Alaskan gyre, the Alaskan current, mm-hmm. right, that comes along the coast from this coastline, broadly speaking, from south to north.
Mm-hmm.
But the Coriolis effect, the spin of the earth, is going to cause the stuff that's moving in that gyre to actually move in onshore
mm-hmm.
because of the way the earth's turning. And so that's going to actually bring whatever's moving along that gyre. It's going to move it in along the coastline of southeastern Alaska, and then tidal currents can carry things in further.
And I guess there's the, I mean, I've read about them, like the Haida Gwaii eddy maybe, and I think there's one off that's often out here, just off the coast, another eddy kind of in the eastern Gulf that hangs out there sometimes, but sometimes it's not there, I guess.
Right, and that could trap things or entrain mm-hmm. things, and then local scale processes can bring them inshore.
No, yeah. It is really fascinating. Yeah. And I think something that would sum up what Matt and I try to do is that, and what I think all ecologists try to do is look at these really complex questions and figure out how they can answer them. And
and
some of the complex questions are what's going to happen with climate change and how can we figure out how this whole system is going to change when we know it's exceedingly complex. And my questions about larval dispersal are also exceedingly complex. And people have been trying to understand what happens to larvae out in the water for many years, and it will continue to be a complex question. But
mark recapture not so easy with those guys.
It's a challenge. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, people have tried to do that and maybe get 0.001% of the larvae that they mark. So, you know, it's really a logic problem.
Yeah.
You know?
And I suppose part of half the fun is figuring out, it's like a puzzle, right? So you just like,
how can you test it?
How can you tease it apart? And,
right, and what data can you collect that will lead you to the best answer?
Yeah, interesting. Well, I should see if there was any other things that you wanted to add before we finish.
Well, I think we always want to say that if anyone sees us out on the beach, we're always happy to talk to people that we meet. We've really enjoyed conversations that we've had at John Brown's Beach with people that have come to visit, and people seem really interested in what we're doing, and we're happy to share and talk to people
and
on the field.
We view that as one of our jobs in general as scientists, but especially here in Sitka as part of our scientists and residency fellowships is, if you ever see us either out at the beach or walking down the street, if you've been to our talks and recognize us or whatever, definitely stop and chat with us about what we're doing. We're always glad to talk about, what we're up to or science in general or what's going on.
And we're just really enjoying getting involved in the community of Sitka. So it's been great to, now have some familiar faces in the town and learn about this place too.
Well, good. And so this show is actually going to, this conversation will be on Sunday, and you guys are going to be here through the beginning of August?
That's right.
1st of August?
Yep. August 6th, I think.
And so if people want to catch you down at John Brown's Beach, low tides are a good time.
Yep. We'll be there every day for at least a couple of hours.
Yeah. And so look for the people carrying around clipboards and...
And buckets and equipment and drills and whatever else.
In the tide pools, right. You're probably going to be the only ones doing that down at John Brown's Beach. So, stop by the beach. And thanks to both of you for coming in and talking to me.
Thanks a lot, Matt.
Absolutely. Yeah. We appreciate it.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded with Cascade Sorty and Matt Bracken just a few days ago. They're the scientists and residency fellows at the Sound Science Center this month. I want to thank them again for coming in and speaking with me about some of their work. And thanks to all of you for listening. And as always, you can find recordings of past shows if you visit sitkanature.org/raven, or you can get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page. If you have observations or photos, things that you're interested or like to share or curious about or would like to share, I'd be interested in seeing them. You can email me, sitkanature@gmail.com. I'll be back in a couple of weeks. We're into August, kind of definitely heading into the fall season for here, and look forward to seeing what that brings. This has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW Sitka.